Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, September 22nd, 2025 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor column, and then I'll read the cover story. As we learned last week, I believe it was, Points of Progress is no longer going to be published in this magazine, so I will substitute in Global Newsstand. And then Science and Nature is AWOL again, so I'll substitute in the Explainer. Then I'll read the Home Forum and the Monitor's View. So getting right into it, before I get right into it, I'll have to apologize up front. There are a lot of French words in the cover story and the From the Editor column. I do not speak French, and so you'll have to excuse my poor pronunciations. At least I'll do it the same each time. Here we go. So getting right into it, the From the Editor column is entitled, A Community Looks to Rewrite Its Reputation. This is written by Colette Davidson, who is a special correspondent, and you can email her at davidsonc@csmonitor.com. And she writes, When I first met Samir Mihi, one of my sources, I had a slightly impertinent question. Why does everyone sit in their cars here? I was in Clichy-Sos-Bois reporting on how this Paris suburb had fared since two teenage boys died by electrocution after being chased by police in 2005, setting off riots across France that destroyed parts of the suburb as well as its reputation. I didn't want to be rude. As an American journalist living in the French capital, I had a double outsider status. First, I was a foreigner. Second, I resided in Paris. Ever since the riots, the French government has been trying to close the gap between Paris and its impoverished suburbs. Some things are better, as my cover story explores, but some things have stayed the same. Notably, there is an absence of public benches. Hence, my question to Mr. Mihi. As in many French suburbs, local authorities have systematically pulled out public benches since 2005 as a way to dissuade loitering, drug use, and other crime. But in doing so, Clichy-Sos-Bois lacks meeting places and, quite simply, places to sit. Instead, locals sit in their cars in the parking lots of social housing blocks, their feet hanging off the edge of their seats with the doors open. They can take in some sun, talk with friends, and get a moment of rest. Large numbers of the mostly foreign-born residents here work physically taxing low-wage jobs, such as cleaning the floors of metro stations and the toilets in office buildings, the jobs that others don't want. Clichy-Sos-Bois also suffers from high levels of unemployment, and young people especially idle here with little to do. Sitting in their cars, chatting with neighbors and friends, provides a sense of community and shared experience. They fix up broken-down vehicles to save money, since cars are essential in places like Clichy-Sos-Bois. Transportation to and from Paris is getting better, but it still takes too long and is unreliable. Without a car, that feeling of being stranded is even more heightened. There are no places to sit around here, so people sit in their cars, responds Mr. Mihi to my question. He seems more matter-of-fact than offended. I'm relieved. I often felt on the brink of giving offense during this assignment simply by being an outsider. Reporting from Clichy-Sos-Bois also filled me with frustration to see people living with so little in a developed country, to witness the discrimination they face for simply having this address, to view the dilapidated housing estates. Could France be doing more? I'm not in a place to judge, only to observe. What I can say is that Clichy-Sos-Bois residents affected me in a surprising way. They were endearing, gritty, sincere, and welcoming. They so desperately want the rest of France to look beyond the riots and see their humanity. They also would like more public benches to sit on. That was the From the Editor column written by Colette Davidson, who is a special correspondent. And this week it was entitled, A Community Looks to Rewrite Its Reputation. And now for the cover story. This week it's entitled, After 20 Years, a Town Still Seeks to Heal. In this Paris suburb, two boys' deaths after an encounter with police caused violent protests. It's still recovering. This is written by Colette Davidson, who is a special correspondent. They do have that paragraph here entitled, Why We Wrote This. In France, the relationship between a non-white youth and the police remains tense. The collective memory of a tragedy 20 years ago highlights this tension and one town's efforts to heal. From Clichy Seuss Boyce, France, Gulce Kaplan was in junior high when she first heard the story of Bona and Zayed, or the story about how her hometown in Clichy Seuss Boyce almost went up in flames. It was springtime then, a little more than a decade ago, Ms. Kaplan recalls. She was with her best friend, wandering through their neighborhood, a twisting maze of social housing blocks. A few euros in hand, they stopped by the local convenience store for snacks and drinks, chatting about life. Her friend mentioned Bona and Zayed, two teenage boys from town who were accidentally electrocuted in a power station after being chased by police about 10 years earlier, in 2005. Ms. Kaplan hadn't yet heard the story that had come to define this outlying Paris suburb, or banlieue. She said, How can you not know the story? It changed our town forever, Ms. Kaplan says. It's been 20 years since the two boys from Clichy Seuss Boyce, Bona Traore and Zayed Bena, instinctively ran from police and then died in an accident inside that power station. It's also been 20 years since the boys' deaths sparked 3 weeks of the most violent urban riots the country had seen in decades, or in decades since. That anger, which bubbled over in the streets of Clichy and then across France, centered around the deaths of these two kids, but it also focused on countless other issues that had been brewing in France's working-class suburbs for decades. Racial discrimination, a lack of job opportunities, a dearth of cultural outlets, and a long-standing tension between young people and the police. Ms. Kaplan was only 5 years old when Bona and Zayed died. She doesn't remember the neighbors huddling together in the midnight streets comforting one another. But like everyone who lives here, Ms. Kaplan carries the weight of what happened. Growing up here means living with the town's memory of that moment and with the labels French society has given the young in immigrant communities: poor, troublesome, futureless. As the 20th anniversary of the boys' deaths approaches, younger generations of Clichois say it's important not to forget what made their town so infamous while not allowing it to define who they are. At a time when ascendant far-right governments are increasingly casting those with immigrant backgrounds as the problem, Clichy's anniversary, residents say, is also about the search for dignity. There has been progress. Some of the surface issues facing Clichy and other French banlieues have been addressed. Police and young people from immigrant communities often work closely together at networks of police-run youth centers, which many cherish even when times are tense. There are countless success stories of community members attending university, starting successful careers. Assa Traore is just one of the people working tirelessly to cultivate the enthusiasm and potential bubbling in the banlieue. Since 2022, Ms. Traore, who is not related to the family of Bona Traore from Clichy Seuss Boyce, runs Generation Leaders, an initiative at the Paris campus of Columbia University. Part of her role is to help coach future leaders from diverse backgrounds, focusing on teaching the art of public speaking, types of activism, or just how to be effective advocates for themselves. We're discovering a generation of young people from working-class suburbs who are full of energy and eager to fight for justice, says Ms. Traore. Her brother, Adama, died in police custody in 2016, and since then, she has become a central figure in France's fight against police brutality. In 2020, she was named one of Time magazine's Guardians of the Year. "We're trying to give young people hope and teach them, be who you are," she says. Addressing police violence isn't the only goal, but it often comes up. Generation Leaders shows up for families after police brutality occurs and makes the rounds in housing projects to help stop violence before it starts. For many young people in the suburbs, police stops are a regular, sometimes daily occurrence, says Dania Dejita, a member of Generation Leaders and a family therapist in Paris. "We try to give residents tools so they know their rights and how to protect themselves." Last May, Generation Leaders held a special event in Paris to honor Franco-Rwandan author Gaël Faye, whose work tackles exile and the silence surrounding collective trauma in families and communities. Under a billowing red tent, young stewards read from Mr. Faye's first novel, Small Country, and then led discussions on French identity and the transmission of memory. "Before a crowd of about 500 people, we all have a story," said Ms. Traoré, "but we need to learn that even with pain from the past, we can move forward. We can heal." But a sense of separateness and a lack of belonging can still drive hopelessness in immigrant communities in banlieues. "Our young people feel discriminated against and frustrated about feeling stuck here. It's hard not to have a victim mentality," says Jean Didier Bonga, director of a youth center in Clichy. "But so many are resilient. They want to do more than their families could. They just want to go to school, get a job. We're doing everything we can to help them get there." Still, most everyone eventually hears the story from 20 years ago. School vacation was nearing its end when Bwana and Zaid joined a group of 8 friends one Thursday afternoon in October 2005, planning to play soccer in nearby Livry-Gargan. About 5 p.m., the group started home towards Clichy Sous Bois, hoping to make it home in time for iftar, or the breaking of the Ramadan fast. On their way, a local man reportedly saw the youth messing around in a construction site and called the police. Within 10 minutes, officers were on the scene. One of the young men was arrested and several others scattered. But Bona Zaid and a third boy, Muhitin Altun, ran farther ahead. With police closing in, they scaled a 10-foot-high enclosure and then jumped behind the wall of a high-voltage electricity substation. A jolt of electricity killed Bwana and Zaid and badly burned Muhitin. By the time evening rolled around, the news of Bwana's and Zaid's deaths had reached Clichy. Young people, already incensed by years of discrimination and police brutality, rose up in anger. Why had the police chased the boys into the power station instead of helping them? Didn't they know the danger lurking behind those walls? That evening, the suburb of 29,000 residents saw its first night of rioting. By Friday morning, 23 cars had been set on fire. "In our neighborhood, the smell of tires burning was never a good sign," says Samir Mihi, a local physical education teacher and activist. "It's what happens when anger rises to the surface." Over the next 3 weeks, violence erupted in the suburbs of Saint-Denis and then spread to housing projects across the country, including in cities such as Nantes, Lyon, and Nice. It wasn't the first time young people from the suburbs had experienced police brutality, but Bona's and Zaid's deaths pushed residents over the edge. Tensions had already been brewing for months. Earlier that year, France's then Interior Minister, Nicolas Sarkozy, said that the banlieues needed to be cleaned with a high-pressure water hose. Then, 2 days before the boys' deaths, Mr. Sarkozy visited the Paris suburb of Argentuel, as residents threw balls of paper and empty cans at him, shouting insults from their apartment windows. He called up to one woman as television cameras rolled. "Have you had enough of this gang of scum? We're trying to get rid of them." After the accident, Mr. Sarkozy denied that police had chased the boys into the power station. That only served to upset communities, setting off another round of rioting. Frantic to find solutions, the government called in the National Army to intervene, and on November 8th, it imposed a three-month state of emergency. On November 14th, 2 weeks after Buana and Zaid died, President Jacques Chirac made a televised speech to the nation, condemning the rioters. He also told young people living in difficult neighborhoods that no matter their origins, they were sons and daughters of the Republic. But it was too late. Images of riot police facing off against hooded men had reached television screens and newspapers around the world. France was on fire, and Clichy Sosboy's image had been tarnished. For the last two decades, the community here has watched the Ebena and Traoré families deal with their grief. Soon after their son's death, Zaid's parents left France for their native Tunisia. But the Traorés still live in Clichy-Sous-Bois, and several of Bono's 12 siblings are active in the community. One of them, Moussa Traoré, is determined not to let the cycle of anger and violence continue. He was only 4 years old when Bono died, but he has lived with his family's grief. "I didn't grow up with any hatred toward police," Mr. Traoré said during an event last fall that brought together police and area youth, "but I have always carried the collective memory of what happened." For over a year, Mr. Traoré has worked as a community mediator in Clichy. He breaks up groups of young people loitering in the hallways or the garages of apartment buildings and spreads the word about the kinds of services available. "I tell them, you're making noise. There are elderly people living here. Think about it," says Mr. Traoré. "I'm not trying to be the police, but since I grew up here, it's easier to make that connection." Cities throughout France have experimented with such mediation efforts as a way to reduce crime. Many have also instituted other preventative measures, such as identifying at-risk youth before delinquency occurs and directing them towards social services. In 2010, Clichy finally saw a new local police station open, something residents had been calling for ever since Mr. Sarkozy ended France's community policing program in 2003. French National Police also operate about 30 after-school programs across the country, an initiative that dates to the early 1990s. These programs help children learn everything, from arts and crafts to sports, and even how to become instructors at the center themselves one day. Part of the idea, too, is to improve the relationship between young people and the police. "At the beginning, the kids called me Madame," says Christelle Poyerson, assistant director of Clichy's police-run Centre de Loisirs et de la Jeunesse, or Leisure and Youth Center. There are centers throughout French communities, but Clichy's was the first in France to be set up in the housing projects. Now, when a kid calls me that, the others say, "That's not Madame. That's Christelle." Crime rates have gone down since the police station opened in 2010, but even before that, there was evidence that the Youth Center initiative was working. In 2005, when violence engulfed the town, local youth told rioters not to touch the police-run youth center. In 2023, when Nahel Merzouk, a 17-year-old French boy of Moroccan and Algerian descent, was shot and killed by police in nearby Nanterre, riots flared a second time, but the police youth center was once again spared. "These kids have the feeling that this is their place," says Pierre Wardeau, director of the youth center in Clichy-Sous-Bois. "They created it. They grew up here." Officers know they can't reach every child. The relationship between young people and the police in this suburb remains fragile in certain housing projects. But many former students have shown resilience, becoming bankers, engineers, and accountants. One former student came back and told me, "You gave me responsibilities. You had confidence in me. Thank you for everything you did for me," says Mr. Waddell. "That moment was worth all the salary in the world." But progress is rarely linear. No one knows that better than Mr. Meehy, who has spent the better part of 2 decades working to lift Clichy up. After the 2005 riots, Mr. Meehy, a local sports education teacher and the Traore's neighbor, co-founded a collective to create more dialogue between residents and France's civic institutions. His organization encouraged young people from the suburbs to get out and vote. It asked leaders in more than 100 French cities to contribute a list of problems confronting young people, which was then presented to the National Assembly. Mr. Meehy also helped find ways for local residents to pay funeral costs and legal fees for Abuana's and Zaid's families. "The young people in this community were really energized to help one another out," says Mr. Meehy, who ran for local office in the years following the 2005 riots. "They wanted to pay homage to the families and make sure no one forgot what happened." In 2015, the police officers implicated in Abuana's and Zaid's deaths were acquitted of failing to help those in danger. Then, in June of 2023, it felt like something broke again after police shot and killed Nahil. This round of urban violence lasted 8 days across France and caused 1 billion euros in property damage. In Clichy, young people set cars on fire, trashed shops, and burned down the local library. Since 2005, the relationship between youth and police has not really changed, says Mr. Meehy. "There's still racism and injustice in our communities. People are still angry." Despite concerted efforts by communities such as Clichy, banlieue has become a code word for all of France's misery. In the media, these suburbs are often referred to as no-go zones, their residents hoodlums. By some estimates, Black and North African men in France are still stopped by police 20 times more often than their white counterparts. France continues to struggle with integrating its 5 million strong North African population, which began arriving en masse in the 1960s when former French colonies, including Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, found independence. By 1975, France's small immigrant population had grown by nearly 2 million. In response, the government hastily built social housing estates on the outskirts of French cities, about 3 million units through the end of the 1970s. New arrivals were promised shops, schools, and playgrounds. "We were convinced that simply going to school and working here would make people French," says Emmanuel Bellinger, a social historian and expert on French suburbs at the Paris 1 Pantheon Sorbonne University. That was the French integration model back then. But large numbers of second and third generation North Africans have had trouble getting out of the banlieues. Suburbs such as Clichy are far from Paris city center, and young people continue to experience discrimination during job interviews and house hunting. Clichy Sous-Bois is like so many other working-class suburbs in that it started as this place that promised territorial cohesion, says Naima Huber-Yahi, a historian and expert in North African immigration. But then problems of urban planning started to creep in. There was increasing poverty, police violence. Immigrants were accused of all that was going wrong. "The suburbs have so many things to offer," she continues, "but they are continually stigmatized and stereotyped, their residents turned into caricatures." In a cozy auditorium in the Antilliers Médicis Cultural Center in the northern part of town, a microphone crackles as Miss Kaplan's voice rings out, softly at first, then growing in confidence. She's introducing three local activists to talk about the stigma of growing up in the banlieue. Ms. Kaplan now works as a journalist at Le Intercel Media, a community radio program within the Antilliers Médicis, whose aim is to give young people from Clichy a voice. Young journalists at Le Intercel lead podcast discussions with local leaders and report on issues that matter to them, such as the renovation of social housing blocks, issues immigrants face, and instances of police brutality. But the radio station and other cultural centers have had trouble recruiting local youths. Momar Sek, Clichy Semboya's employment and inclusion officer, says many residents limit themselves. Young people agree. Many young people look around and say, "Well, I guess this is it for me," says Eli Serre, a 24-year-old Clichyist and one of the exceptions. He graduated from the prestigious Sciences Po, a university in Paris, with a degree in urban planning. Clichy is doing its best to create more success stories, especially because half its population is under the age of 30. There is an abundance of youth centers and activities that serve its multicultural community, rich with more than 100 nationalities. Mayor Olivier Klein, who grew up here, has helped residents live with dignity, focusing on renovating run-down housing estates like the Chain Point 2, the epicenter of the 2005 riots. A tramway now helps residents get to Paris more quickly, and the town boasts some of the most green spaces in the region. The Parc Départemental de la Fossé-Massillon was significantly enlarged between 2011 and 2022, creating new wooded areas, a meadow for picnicking, and a fitness trail. Still, much of the town is made up of social housing blocks where families of as many as 10 individuals live in spaces of about 1,000 square feet or less. There is no town center. Clichy has one of the highest poverty rates in France at 42%, and 4 out of 10 people under the age of 25 are unemployed. Given its reputation, Mayor Klein has had trouble getting businesses to invest here. Ms. Kaplan says that, on the one hand, she's so obsessed with her hometown that she wrote her master's thesis about it. On the other hand, she can't understand why people stay. I asked my uncle, who's married with kids and a good job, "Don't you want to leave?" says Ms. Kaplan. He just says, "No, this place is my family." Part of her role at Le Intercel is to provide a platform for young people to piece together their thoughts about their town and gain agency over Clichy's future, as well as their own. Young people here see that the words used to describe them for the last 20 years don't correspond to reality, says Ulysses Mathieu, coordinator for Le Intercel. It obviously creates distrust and anger. The radio station is planning an October tribute to Buana and Zaid, as well as a news report on the changes Clichy Sosbois has gone through since the 2005 riots. On the wall behind her desk, Ms. Kaplan has a vision board covered in photos and sayings about her Turkish origins. At the top is a black and white photo of Buana and Zaid with the words, "We won't forgive, we won't forget." Once I went on a reporting trip outside Paris and someone said, "Oh, you're from Clichy Sosbois? That's a ghetto. How can you live there?" says Ms. Kaplan. "I wish people could understand the reality of living here and all of this energy." These days, the hum of cranes and electric drills has become the background music of everyday life in Clichy Sosbois. New apartment complexes, playgrounds, and roads are rising at a breakneck pace. In 2027, a new metro line will stop here, allowing people to reach central Paris in 30 minutes. The community is also in the midst of tearing down the Chenet Point 2 projects, with plans to replace them with new apartments and green spaces by 2030. All of the changes have created mixed feelings among residents who want Clichy to improve but not lose its identity. My mom says, "I don't even recognize my town anymore. The buildings are growing like trees," says Ms. Kaplan. But building up the beleaguered town and giving residents the services they need to live with dignity is a first start in addressing the challenges of living here, observers say. It also means Bona's and Zaid's deaths have not been in vain, even if, in the Paris suburb of Clichy-Sous Bois, their story is impossible to forget. Every October, the town's city hall hosts a commemoration service next to the local junior high, where a marble plaque stands alongside a street named in the boy's honor. Two of the Traoré brothers organize an annual youth soccer match in their memory. While the story of Bona and Zaid has at times filled Clichy with darkness, residents say memories of the boys have also filled it with light. "Sometimes it feels like torture to live here," says Ms. Kaplan, "but every time I leave, I feel like I'm in the jungle, and I'm always relieved to come back." You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Well, like I mentioned at the top of the show, Points of Progress is no longer with us. So I'm substituting in the Global Newsstand. What this is a name of a newspaper, where it's from, a headline, and a paragraph. So the first one is Le Monde Paris. Le Monde from Paris. U.S. tariff policies shift the chessboard for global trade. Could President Donald Trump's tariff policy and his actions on the international stage backfire on him? States an editorial. This blowback is most evident in countries in the so-called Global South that were hit with arbitrarily assessed tariff increases. In response, these countries have tended to strengthen their ties with China. Two major countries in the Global South, India and Brazil, in particular, pushed back against Washington's dictate by turning towards Beijing. Trump, who claimed to want to limit China's global influence, in reality is actually bolstering it through his erratic foreign policy. The next one is the Daily Maverick from Cape Town, South Africa. India should look to Africa for manufacturing opportunities. The United States, India's largest export market, has imposed sharply higher tariffs on a range of Indian goods, writes Veda Vaidyanathan, a fellow at the Center for Social and Economic Progress in New Delhi. Faced with this asymmetrical disadvantage, some Indian companies are shifting production for U.S.-bound orders to African plants. While the immediate lure of tariff circumvention via Africa bases is real, it may prove fleeting if U.S. laws allowing duty-free trade from some African exports lapses. Success will require India's sustained engagement, strengthening ties with Africa's regional value chain is vital. The next one is from The Guardian, from London. The UN must find its courage again. Birthday parties should be a time for celebration, but when my former United Nations colleagues meet to mark the organization's 80th birthday or 80th anniversary in September, good cheer is likely to be in short supply, writes Martin Griffiths, former UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs. The UN is in crisis. This great institution is desperately short of funding and, more importantly, relevance. In Ukraine, Palestine, Sudan, and others, the UN is relegating itself to an increasingly marginal place in primary peacemaking. It would be easy to blame this on the UN's well-known structural flaws. The true issue is that a culture of caution has seeped into the organization, a sense of inertia and resignation in the face of political deadlock. This great global project has to find the courage to make itself relevant once again. Now for Al Jazeera from Doha, Qatar, Europe should step up to handle U.S. deportees. Rwanda agreed to accept 250 migrants under the Trump administration's expanding third-party deportation program, writes columnist Taffy Mahaka. The program marks the third deportation agreement of its kind on the African continent. The U.S. is now sending people to Rwanda, Eswatini, and South Sudan, countries already struggling to care for their own citizens. These countries are among the poorest nations in the world, with per capita incomes just a tiny fraction of their former colonial rulers in Europe. Expecting them to carry the burden of America's deportees is not only unjust, it's absurd. European countries have both the means and the institutions to absorb deportees, yet Africa is asked to shoulder the burden. And the final one here is the Toronto Star from Toronto. Workers have the right to avoid wildfire smoke. Our current wildfire season is on track to be the second worst on record, states Flannery Dean, a writer and editor. I felt inordinately irritated by the advice to stay inside, keep the kids at home. Most of us can't even stay home from work to care for our children when they're ill. What are the chances we'll be allowed to take a toxic air pollution day? In the United States, the Trump administration is busy dismantling expert-led social infrastructure that touches on every aspect of human health and the environment. Canada's response has been to expedite energy, mining, and infrastructure projects. Instead, we need supportive labor protections and substantive investments in clean indoor air. Now, all of this was compiled by staff, and the illustrations, which I have not described to you, are by Karen Norris from the staff. Like I mentioned at the top of the show, science and nature is AWOL, so I'll read the explainer. This week it's entitled, What Changes Will Trump's Big Beautiful Bill Bring for College Students? This is written by Ira Porter, who is a staff writer, and they do have that paragraph here that says, Why We Wrote This. As classes resume on college campuses across the U.S., schools and students are absorbing the changes that the recent law will bring to everything, from educational loans to taxes on endowments. As college dorm rooms in the United States fill with fresh sheets and mini fridges, students and their families are facing a new borrowing environment. President Donald Trump's big, beautiful bill, signed into law on July 4th, has changed the amount students can ask for, including for graduate education, such as medical and law school, and how the money is to be paid back. The new tax law also aims to increase accountability for colleges in terms of protecting student investment. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that the bill will cut more than $300 billion in fundings for colleges over a 10-year period. The government will also take in funds from increased taxes on wealthy schools with large endowments. In a survey published in August by a U.S. News and World Report, less than a quarter, 20%, of students polled said they fully understand the changes brought by the tax law and what they imply. The big, beautiful bill has altered the financial landscape in higher education in a number of key areas. Now, what follows is a question and answer piece. Question: What changes can student borrowers and their families expect? Answer: Starting next July 1st, there will be just two repayment options for new loans, reduced from a handful of options, including the Biden-era Saving on a Valuable Education plan, which is being phased out. The Department of Education has said the new law is simplifying the student loan repayment system. The new options include the standard repayment plan, which features a fixed monthly payment that could be paid off in 10 to 25 years, depending on how much was borrowed. The other is the repayment assistant plan, an income-driven plan that sets monthly payments at 1% to 10% of a borrower's adjusted gross income. It extends payment to 30 years, up from the previous options of 20 or 25 years. The government's loan simulator page, where students and their families can figure out the loan terms that are best for them, does not yet reflect the legislative changes. Longer payment periods and cuts to financial aid will force students to take out private loans, for which there is no option for loan forgiveness, says Sabrina Calizans, executive director of the nonprofit Student Debt Crisis Center. The bill also changes the current Parent Plus loan program by capping borrowing. Currently, parents can borrow the full amount for the cost of children to attend school, minus any other financial aid students receive. Parents have some avenues right now to grandfather existing loan limits and repayments. But starting in July, the aggregate cap will be $65,000 and the annual limit will be $20,000. Parents can borrow for multiple children, but the $65,000 cap applies to each child. The changes, opponents of the bill say, will affect low-income families more. Proponents say the law will force colleges to keep tuition costs in check. Additionally, Graduate Plus loans, which currently allow borrowers to receive the full amount of costs for graduate school, will be eliminated. Such loans will be capped at a lifetime total of $100,000 or $20,500 per year. Professional grad school loans for law, medical, and dental school will be capped at $200,000 total or $50,000 annually. Right now, Grad Plus, Parent Plus, they're essentially a blank check from the federal government. Whatever the college says it needs to change or to charge, the federal government has to give students a loan up to that amount, no questions asked, says Preston Cooper, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Mr. Cooper wrote an analysis breaking down the percentage of graduate students currently borrowing above the limits listed in the new bill, a percentage that he says is not significant. About 20% of students in master's degree programs currently borrow above the $20,500 cap, he wrote. This share drops to just 10% at public institutions which have lower tuition. He acknowledges that students in professional schools might have to turn to private lenders, but that their earnings will put them in the top 10% when they graduate, which should enable them to pay them back. According to the Association of American Medical Colleges, the average cost for a public medical school education for 2024 to 2025 was $286,454 and $390,448 for private schools. A study done in 2006, when the Grad Plus program was created, Mr. Cooper says, showed that when students had access to unlimited loan amounts, schools charged more for tuition. He thinks the schools taking advantage of the program will be forced to rein in tuition after the program's elimination, which he favors. For her part, Ms. Calazans envisions that the shift could be dramatic. What will happen is folks will either shift their career paths to not even pursue those degrees, especially low-income folks, or we are going to see folks maxing out on their federal aid, but also taking on a significant amount of private student loan debt, she says. Just over one-third of respondents in the U.S. News & World Report poll said they are considering less schooling as a result of the bill's provisions. Question. How does the new law aim to hold colleges and universities more accountable? Answer. Under the new bill, something called the Earnings Test Initiative will begin July 1, 2026. Undergraduate programs can lose federal student loan eligibility if their graduates don't exceed the earnings of the minimum income for adults with high school diplomas. This is different from the original version of the bill proposed by the House of Representatives, which suggested that colleges pay penalties based on former students' unpaid federal loans. The earnings test applies to graduate programs as well and calls for the same penalties if program graduates don't earn more than adults with bachelor's degrees. The test, Mr. Cooper says, provides accountability for programs that are producing just egregiously bad outcomes. And the final question, what can schools expect in terms of taxes on endowments? And the final answer, in a move that could have ripple effects at some of the nation's wealthiest schools, the new tax bill raises the endowment tax or excise tax on those colleges' investment earnings from the current rate of 1.4% to either 4% or 8%, depending on student enrollment. private, nonprofit colleges and universities with endowments that equal $500,000 to $750,000 per capita will pay the current rate, but those whose endowments are $750,001 to $2 million will pay 4%. Schools with more than $2 million per student will pay 8%. Schools with fewer than 3,000 enrolled students will be exempt from the new changes. The impact of this tax will also be felt far beyond our campus and our hometown, wrote President Maury McInnes of Yale University in a letter to the campus community on July 3rd. Yale is one of the schools that will pay 8%. Taxing universities undermines the education and research that fuel life-saving medical breakthroughs, life-changing innovations, and economic growth in communities across the country and around the globe, she added. Yale estimates it will pay $280 million in the first year of the new tax, which starts in 2026. Some experts believe tuition increases might be one result of the tax increases. Some of these colleges will be paying more in excise tax than their annual financial aid, says Mark Kontrowitz, an expert on financial aid. The point that these colleges are making, he says, is that the federal government is taking money away that could be used for making college more affordable. And now for the home forum in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. There is only one very small article, but I'll read it. It is entitled, Opening a Window on My World. When we flung aside our shutters, our life grew brighter. In more ways than one. And this was written by Danny Heitman. The house our family moved into 3 decades ago included a large bank of windows in the living room, which gave us a wide view of the front yard and street. Our kids needed more privacy as they grew, so we installed shutters to make things cozy. After many seasons, our son and daughter moved out to lead lives of their own. When my son, William, returned from college to visit last year, he asked if, for the first time in years, we could swing the shutters wide open. He'd spent a gray winter in a cold city, and the prospect of sun on his face while he sipped coffee on the couch seemed especially welcome. After obliging his request, I wondered why we shuttered our windows for so long. The yard had gradually changed with an abundance of trees and shrubs that now subtly screened us from the passersby. The logic of living behind a louvered slats no longer made sense. Opening our front windows opened me up, too, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. Sunlight flooded from the front room, burnishing our old wooden floor, a warm shade of gold. I now had an unobstructed view of the bird feeder hanging from our crepe myrtle, giving me a front row seat in a lively theater of goldfinches and titmice, cardinals, and chickadees. I can now see the life of the street and nearby sidewalk, too. The strolling grandmother, the young runner, the radiant grade schooler trying out her new bike. The view proved so grand that we decided to keep it long after William returned to college. I found myself drawn more to the window than to the TV in the nearby den, so I've been watching less and spending more time focused on the life right out in front of me. In an anxious time for America and the world, cutting back on TV has been a boon, I think, for my attitude. Because a spot near an open window makes a really good reading station, I've stocked the table near my armchair with a pleasant pillar of books, a few novels, some history, and a handful of poetry beckon on the odd afternoon when my chores are done and I can dip into random volumes, the changing slant of light marking the day's slow progress towards dusk. Those bookish hours have been a source of calm in a season of challenge, and they wouldn't have been as rich or rewarding without that set of windows as my companion. But our open windows have been a bit more than an exercise in sedentary ease. Look out a window long enough and you'll eventually be invited irresistibly outside. Quite often, while sipping tea from my cushy perch, I notice that our visiting finches, tiny birds of bottomless appetite, have once again emptied all the sunflower seeds from the tube feeder. That nudges me outdoors to replenish the supply, an errand that inevitably leads me to a half a dozen more domestic urgencies. the weed that needs pulling, the porch that needs sweeping, the potted fern thirsty for another swig from our watering can. Before I know it, an hour or two has passed, my mind comfortably carried on the current of small things to do. These outdoor interludes, so good for mind and body, wouldn't happen so often without those windows to tease me beyond my threshold, portals to my private Eden. All of this happened, I'll point out again, because one of my children asked if we could open our shutters. So often, when I think of transformative change, the usual things come to mind. A radical new meal plan, an aggressive new exercise program, an ambitious app that can teach me Chinese or French. All of those things have promise, and yet I've been moved to think that even small adjustments in one's life can bring big dividends. If you don't believe me, then throw open your shutters and see what happens next. And now for the Monitor's View in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. These are articles written by the editorial staff, and there are two of them, so here we go. The first one is entitled, A Post-Shooting Light on Prayer as Action. The August 27th shooting at Annunciation Catholic School in Minneapolis saw hundreds of Minnesotans come together to support the affected individuals and families and each other. They did this through small acts of commemoration and kindness, such as candles, flowers, and thanks to teachers and emergency responders. They also gathered in parks and places of worship, seeking to heal heartbreak and find ways to prevent a recurrence of the violence that killed 2 children and injured 21 others. At a service at Annunciation Church, the Reverend Dennis Zirin urged parishioners to cling to their faith amid darkness and grieving until a little light starts to dawn. That, he said, is what we wait for, what we welcome. Since the shooting, however, a political firestorm has ensued in the wake of comments by those impatient for greater action on gun control. These are kids that should be learning with their friends, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey said after the shooting. They should be able to go to school or church in peace, without the fear or risk of violence. Don't just say this is about thoughts and prayers right now, he said. We need action now. We have too many guns in America. The political right is now accusing the left of diminishing and disrespecting religious practice. The left contends thoughts and prayers is a platitude to disguise inaction on weapons access and use. Yet this dispute sets up a false dichotomy between political activism and the notion of prayer as passive acceptance. It would obscure the fact that a substantial portion of Americans rely on prayer to provide comfort and spur practical spiritual action. According to the 2025 Pew Religious Landscape Study, prayer is a part of life for more than 60% of Americans, with 44% saying they pray daily. I believe prayer works because it changes us, the Reverend Shannon Johnson Kirshner of Central Presbyterian Church in Atlanta told CNN. Prayer gives us the vision to see everyone as God's beloved, she said, and then it motivates us into acting that out in a way we live our lives and use our resources. In his post-shooting sermon, Father Zarin shared this prayer-rooted vision. There is no darkness that God can't bring life from. There's no sorrow that God can't spring joy from, he assured the congregation. And the next Monitor's View article is, Where Water, Teamwork Runs Deep. In Central Asia, summers bring both abundance and scarcity. As crops grow and then ripen in the dry heat, water becomes increasingly scarce. And with warmer seasons in recent years, river levels have fallen to new lows. That has led something else to sprout up, water diplomacy. Among the region's 5 nations, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan, historic rivalry over water has turned into intense dialogue aimed at cooperation. The times require more dynamic action from us, said Kazakh Deputy Prime Minister Kana Bozumbayev at a recent meeting of the region's Commission for Managing Transboundary Waterways. August saw a flurry of measures in this crossroads of Eurasia. Uzbekistan unveiled a plan to conserve water by modernizing its antiquated irrigation network. Kazakhstan funded restoration for the receding Caspian Sea, with Turkmenistan joining the push. A few months early, Tajikistan, which houses the vast Bari Tojik Reservoir, agreed to share millions of cubic meters of water with Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. Water diplomacy goes beyond simple cooperation, says Barbara Janas Palata of the International Water Management Institute. It's important to ensure all parties' interests are taken into account, she says. Central Asia's openness to joint action is notable, given that these former Soviet republics have had contentious disagreements over borders previously demarcated by Moscow. More than two decades ago, the International Crisis Group dubbed this legacy a Pandora's box that could exacerbate resource competition and ethnic divisions. Contrary to such predictions, the countries have successfully pursued territorial peacemaking even under authoritarian strongman rule. Earlier this year, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan resolved a border dispute in the picturesque, populous, and fertile Fergana Valley, where hundreds of people have died in clashes over the past three decades. Soon after, the European Union participated in the first-ever EU Central Asia Summit. In addition to shared goals on water and environment cooperation, the joint declaration referred to promoting and protecting fundamental freedoms. The region's journey in water and land negotiations has required reciprocity and mutual respect. These features offer a guide to other parts of the world grappling with similar issues, such as the three Nile River nations of Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan. And a similar approach could also inform needed economic and democratic transformation in Central Asia itself. Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.